All right, good morning, everyone. It's great to see everyone. Thank you. Welcome back to my favorite 30 minutes of the entire week, Erev Shabbos, Parsha Inspiration. As has been our minhag, three ideas, 30 minutes to energize us and to charge us as we go into what is now my favorite day of the week, none other than Shabbos Kodesh. So here we go. It is not the same, I will say. Obviously, I miss seeing so many of you in Shul. And while this is a great opportunity to learn together, it will never replace our in-person interactions. And please God, I look forward to the day when we can all be learning together. If not here in Boca, then in Yerushalayim. Certainly that would be nice. So, okay, this is a fantastic parsha. So many wonderful themes. We're going to touch upon three of them here this morning. The first idea comes from the notion that we are introduced to two leaders in our parsha this morning. Number one, we're introduced to Pinchas. And number two, we're introduced to Yehoshua. And my question is very simple. Why are they both highlighted in the exact same parsha? Now, you'll tell me that it's a very simple reason, Rabbi Moskowitz, that they're highlighted in the same parsha. Pinchas, of course, he's the hero of our parsha. The end of last week's parsha, Bilam, when he realizes he's not going to be successful at cursing the Jewish people, so he goes to plan B and tries to entice them into promiscuity. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But Pinchas, of course, comes along, saves the day. So Pinchas deserves, right? If Yisro gets a name of Parsha after him, certainly Pinchas, who does such a dramatic and courageous act, he gets a Parsha named after him as well. But why is Yehoshua mentioned in this Parsha? We're going to read about the transition of power from Moshe to Yehoshua in this week's Parsha. And the question is why? Right, if anything, Moshe, the reason why there needs to be a successor is because Moshe sins, and Hashem tells him he's not allowed to go into the land of Israel. Now, depending on which parish you follow, that sin either happened in Parsha Shlach or in Parsha Chukas. Now, I know I'm confusing you, because it's in Parsha Chukas where Hashem tells Moshe you can't go into the land of Israel, but the Abarbanel has a whole understanding that it's really for the sin that happened in Parsha Shlach with the Meraglim. But Hashem didn't want to embarrass Moshe when he was punishing the other people, and so he couches his punishment in the context of the hitting of the rock. No matter how you slice it, it's either Chukas, it's Shlach, it's not our Parsha. So out of any Parsha in the Torah to reference the transition of power from Moshe to Yehoshua, why choose this Parsha? In fact, if I'm Pinchas, what am I thinking? You know, thanks God, you gave me a Parsha with my name on it, and then you totally overshadowed my kavod, because in that very same parsha, you appoint Yehoshua as the leader and not me as the leader. So why here, out of all places, do we choose not just to reference Pinchas, but do we choose to reference both Pinchas and Yehoshua? So the simplest interpretation, and I would venture to say that out of the people listening to this right now, if I polled you, I would say 99% of you would give this answer, is that you would say it's plan A and plan B. Plan A was for Pinchas to be the leader. He was originally going to succeed Moshe in leading the Jewish people into the land of Israel. And yet, after Moshe sees the way Pinchas acts, he gets a little nervous and he gets a little reticent and he appoints Yehoshua instead. What was Moshe Rabbeinu so nervous about? He was nervous because Pinchas' act, while it was dramatic, was also a little bold. And you and I both know that if you have a fiery leader that's going to act in that way, it doesn't always play over so well with the people. And so instead, Moshe goes to plan B, which is Yehoshua. So plan A was Pinchas. Pinchas does this very dramatic act. And yes, he acts heroically, but he acts like a zealot and a vigilante. And so instead, Moshe Rabbeinu says, I don't know if Pinchas is the right guy. And so instead, he switches over to Yehoshua. That's plan B. But I want to share a different interpretation. It's an idea I speak about a lot. I wrote about it in a blog the other week about Norman the Dorman. But it's an idea I believe very strongly in. And that is, there are two types of people in the world, right? You can compare it to baseball fans. You can compare it to people. But essentially, there are two paths to greatness. One is a path of greatness that is built off of something that's bold and dramatic. It's an action that is spectacular and courageous. And so, for example, when you hear stories of people lifting cars off of someone pinned under the car, that's what I'll call a Pinchas moment. There are moments that grab headlines. They're heroic moments, but they're not everyday life for me and you. Everyday life for me and you is not captured by Pinchas' moments, right? Rather, most of our lives are comprised of actions that are constant inconsistent. They are the opposite of Pinchas' moments. And so perhaps that's why the Torah contrasts Pinchas on the one hand with Yehoshua on the other hand. Because Pinchas' actions were bold, they were dramatic, and they grabbed the headlines. And while that's important and it saved the Jewish people from an enormous plague, it's also a one-time event. And no matter how impactful it is, it comes and goes. It's never going to represent what normal life is going to look like for the majority of us. Yehoshua, we know, is the exact opposite of a Pinchas moment. Torah tells us in Mishar, so Yehoshua ben Nun, na'ar lo yamish mitocha ohel. Yehoshua was defined by his constancy, consistency. He showed up day in and day out. And so while Yehoshua's actions may not have grabbed any headlines, he wouldn't have won in a soundbite war between Fox News and CNN, right? But Yehoshua is represented. What defines him and ultimately represents his pathway to greatness is that everything he did was constant, day in and day out. Who ultimately takes over the mantle of leadership? Pinchas or Yehoshua? So while the Torah gives Pinchas a parsha that bears his name, Yehoshua doesn't have a parsha that bears his name. The Torah gives Pinchas a parsha that bears his name because he did act heroically. And his actions were incredibly necessary. He saved the Jewish people from a horrific plague. Ultimately, who receives the mantle of leadership? It is none other than Yehoshua. Because while bold and dramatic moments that grab the headlines, while those one-off lines are the ones that are going to be shared on social media and go viral, ultimately, our lives are defined by the things that we do with consistency, day in and day out. As I pointed out in the past, the Rambam tells us this explicitly. What's fascinating about the Rambam in this Mishnah Torah is not just what he writes, but how he chooses to organize what he writes. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, who I grew up with in Boston, Dr. Isidore Tursky, Rabbi Dr. Isidore Tursky, has a whole essay on this. And he talks about how what defines the Rambam, again, isn't just what he says, but how he chooses to organize his Mishnah Torah. That's extremely important. And when it comes to the Rambam's Sefer Ahava, his Book of Love, so what would you and I expect to be in the Book of Love? We would expect to be maybe the laws of meditation, right? The laws of, I don't know, I put a lot of things, marriage, right? The Book of Love, what's more lovely than marriage? It's not what the Rambam puts in his Book of Love. Rambam puts the laws of brachos, the laws of mezuzah, the laws of bris milah, and you sit there and you wonder to yourself, that's love? Love is a mezuzah on my door. When's the last time you walked through your door and you looked at the mezuzah and you're just overwhelmed with ecstatic love to God? Ha, I love you, God, right? When's the last time you did that? When's the last time you've been in a bris milah and you're just like, I love God, right? You might be sentimental about other parts there, but, right, that's love? So the answer, of course, is that the Rambam tells us himself why he puts there. He says, and I'm going to read his language, in the introduction to his Mishnah Torah, he actually tells you why he puts what he puts there. And he says, Echlol bo ha-mitzvos shehein tadiros. I'm including in my Book of Love those things that are done with frequency, consistently, day in and day out. What is more consistent than brachos? We say 100 a day. What is more consistent for a male than a bris milah? Right? What is more consistent than a mezuzah on the doors of our rooms and our buildings? And so the Rambam says, you want to know what love is? Love is doing things with regularity, consistency, day in and day out. And again, as I've said in the past, I'll give you a little bit of marriage advice right now. If you only tell your spouse you love them once a year on the anniversary, if you only acknowledge a very important person in your life once a year, twice a year, you're going to be sleeping on the couch a lot. You and I both know that relationships are made up of small day-in and day actions which represent and showcase love between two individuals. So it's a text message throughout the day. It's a note in a lunchbox saying, I love you, I can't wait to see you later, right? Those are the things which define love far more than any anniversary card once a year. And so idea number one was the contrast between Pinchas and Yehoshua. That Pinchas was bold and dramatic. It was one time, but it's also not who takes over the leadership of the Jewish people. It's Yehoshua, who, if you think about it, we know very little about. He is a very unspectacular character in the Torah. In Nevi'im, we learn a little bit more about him, but in the Torah itself, he is a very unspectacular character. And yet he takes over a very important position, namely, leader of the Jewish people. Because the Torah is trying to provide us with a paradigm. It's trying to provide us with a contrast of what it is our pathway to greatness. That our pathway to greatness is not necessarily through the Pinchas moments, but it's through the Yehoshua moments. Lo yamish mitoch ha'oel, that Yehoshua was defined by showing up day in, day out, serving Hashem with consistency. That's idea number one. Idea number two comes from the end of last week's Parsha and the beginning of this week's Parsha. And that is that we talk about Pa'or, right? Al Devar Pa'or, that the Jewish people are punished because of what they did with Pa'or. But if you look at the Pesukim very carefully, and this is a good Shabbos table conversation, look at the end of last week's Parsha, the last paragraph of last week's Parsha, and question the people at your Shabbos table. What was the sin of Baal Pa'or? Now, you'll tell me, right, that the sin is obvious. Wasn't it idolatry? And then some of you might tell me, well, isn't the sin obvious? Maybe it was promiscuity. And then if you look in the Pesukim, you'll notice very quickly that it's actually both promiscuity and idolatry. And the Torah is very confusing in that it switches interchangeably back and forth between those two sins. So the question is why? Which sin is it? What exactly was so egregious about Pa'or that Hashem caused this horrific plague, killed 24,000 Jews? All we're told is Al Devar Pa'or. Something about Pa'or was so egregious. So Rashi tells us, right, that the ambiguity is not necessarily as clear-cut as we think, but rather, one was the means and one was the ends, right? What was the means, what was the end? Says Rashi, Shifkir benoseim luznus, that yes, there was promiscuity, Kidei lahatoschem achar Pa'or. In other words, promiscuity was the means to a greater end, which was idolatry. In other words, they were seducing them. They were luring in the Jewish men through the means of promiscuity. But once they would have the men in a compromised position, what would they say? Boy, do I have a treat for you. And it ain't me. It's the idol that's sitting next to me. And if you bow down to the idol, you can have me too. Right? So that's how Rashi reads this ambiguity in the Pesukim. Now yes, both existed. One was the means, one was the end. The means, they used promiscuity as a mechanism to be able to lure the men into something far more egregious, namely idolatry. But I want to offer a different suggestion this morning, one that I think captures both ideas and I think is very profound. Right? We don't know a lot about Pa'or. All we're told in the Torah is that there was some idol named Pa'or, Al-Dvar Pa'or. The Jewish people are punished because of Pa'or. But thankfully, we have Torah Shebaal Peh. And the Mishnah in Masechet Sanhedrin tells us a little bit more about this idol named Pa'or. And the Mishnah tells us, Ha-Po'er Atzmo Lebal Pa'or, Zohi Avodaso. That one who defecates in front of Pa'or has violated the prohibition of serving the idol Pa'or. In other words, the way people used to serve Pa'or, this idol, is by relieving themselves in front of him. Now, I happen to be learning with my son now, Maseches Avodah Zarah, and this talk about Lot and Avodah Zarah, different idolaters, and the way they were worshipped. And apparently, defecating or relieving yourself in front of an idolatry was a very common practice back then, which I kind of glanced over and shrugged my shoulders, but my son was not letting me have any of it. He was a little bit bothered by how that's covetic to an idol to relieve yourself in front of it. So I tried explaining that the whole notion of idolatry is completely illogical. So once you go down that route, right, relieving yourself in front of the idol, right, why not? So Rashi, so the Mishnah over there tells us, Ha-Po'er Atzmo, Labal Po'er Zoyed Avodaso. How do they worship Po'er? By relieving themselves in front of him. What does that mean? What does that mean? So I believe the answer is that they used to worship Pa'or. As the saying goes, a man's got to go when a man's got to go. In other words, Pa'or was worshipped by doing whatever felt natural to you and whatever made you feel good. So you needed to go to the bathroom? Go for it. Feeling any other urges? Enjoy. Peor was defined by a philosophy that said, you never have to tell yourself no. So which one is it? Was Peor an idol? Or was Peor promiscuity? The answer is it's irrelevant. It makes no difference if it's one, if it's both, if it was neither. What's important is what was at the root of both idolatry and promiscuity. And that is that Peor promoted a culture that says do whatever you want to do. No restrictions, no limitations, no self-control needed whatsoever. A life of promiscuity says, I have urges, I have desires, I have needs, let me go after them, right? I want to act upon whatever I want to act, whenever I want to act upon it, however I want to act upon it. No restrictions, no limitations, no rules, nobody coming along and telling me no as well, right? And so that's what Peor represented. Peor represented a mindset, it represented a philosophy, and comes along Hashem, and he says that is what's so dangerous. In other words, the Jews had served idols other times, and I'm sure there was promiscuity, right? What was so destructive about Peor was the philosophy it represented, was this carefree, zero self-control, no limitations mentality. Because after all, what is further from a Jewish mindset than that? If there's one thing that Judaism is defined by, it's rules and restrictions. Not rules and restrictions in a way that are overly burdensome, right? But rules and restrictions which allow us actually to live a much freer and elevated lifestyle. And so if you think about what all the 613 mitzvos are, they are rules and restrictions. If you think about how the Rambam, we spoke about how the Rambam codifies his Mishneh Torah, what does the Rambam put in his Hilchos Kedusha? The laws of holiness. So again, if I were writing laws of holiness, I don't know, maybe I would put in the learning Torah, I would put in Hilchos Tefillah, right, the laws of Tefillah. That's not what the Rambam puts in his Hilchos Kedusha. The Rambam puts two things in his Hilchos Kedusha. The laws of marital relationships and the laws of Kashrus. Why? Because those are two areas in Judaism which define us by our ability to say no. Right? Food. What more than food? I see a piece of cake, I want the piece of cake. I eat it now. Right? I see a cheeseburger, I want a cheeseburger, I eat it now. Kashrus, by definition, Judaism says you can't eat whatever you want whenever you want it. You and I both know that from yesterday. Right? There are rules and limitations on what you and I can eat and how we can eat and when we can eat it. Same thing comes to marital relationships. Judaism doesn't just say, enjoy, right? Have whatever you want, with whoever you want, whenever you want it. There are limitations. There are restrictions. Many, actually, husbands and brides and grooms don't enjoy those at the beginning, but those are rules and restrictions, and they're what define Judaism. Says the Rambam, that's Kedusha. Because Kedusha, holiness, is defined by our ability to tell ourselves no. We've discussed this in the past when it comes to Parshas Yisro. In Parshas Yisro, if you notice, very clearly and explicitly, when we talk about the story of Har Sinai, there's one word, or one description of a word that comes up over and over again, and that is boundaries. There was a boundary around Har Sinai. There was a limit to where the Jewish people could go around Har Sinai. You couldn't go any further. Why so many rules and restrictions? Because that was the holiest moment in Jewish history. And whenever you find holiness, you're also going to find boundaries. And so this mindset of Peor, which says, enjoy life, no rules, no restrictions, never having to tell yourself no. Why did the Torah call that out? Because that mindset is so counterintuitive. It's so antithetical to a Jewish perspective where we are defined by our ability to tell ourselves no. We are defined by our ability to learn and to display self-control. I'll tell you a funny story that I once heard from Dr. David Pelkovitz, who told me that he was once giving a lecture about self-control to parents at a school on the Upper East Side. I won't tell you the name of the school, but he finishes this long lecture, hour lecture about the importance of teaching your children self-control. And afterwards, in setting boundaries in the house and technology, etc. Afterwards, a parent comes over to him and says with complete, with sincerity, he says, Dr. Pelkovitz, how can I tell my children no when I can't say no to myself? Right? How can I tell my children no when I can't say no to myself? In other words, that's the challenge. challenges we have to teach ourselves and our children, self-control. It's at the bedrock of what Judaism stands for. You can't understand and appreciate halacha unless you have a backdrop of self-control. And so idea number two is this notion that Peor represented not promiscuity or idolatry, it represented a mindset, a philosophy. And a philosophy that says, no rules, no restrictions, no limitations, carefree, do whatever I want, whenever I want, however I want, and I'm never going to tell myself no. Judaism is the exact opposite. We are defined by our rules and restrictions. We are defined by our ability to tell ourselves no. We are defined by our ability to maintain a certain sense of self-control. So idea number one was a beautiful idea about Pinchas versus Yehoshua, two models of leadership. Ultimately, the one that sustains itself is Yehoshua, the consistency, the constant regularity that we perform our service of Hashem, not necessarily defined by those bold one-off Pinchas moments. Idea number two is that critically important idea about what did Peor represent? Peor Atzmo, Labal Peor. Peor represented a mindset, represented a philosophy that was dangerous and antithetical to Judaism. Last idea I want to share with you is one of my favorites. It's not from me. It's from Rabbi Soloveitchik. I'll tell you where I read it for the first time. I read it for the first time in Rabbi Riskin's autobiography. He has a beautiful write-up of it there. But I'll share it with you here because I think it's a magnificent idea, and I think it'll give you a lot of food for thought tonight as we go into Shabbos. Of course, in this week's Parsha, as I referenced earlier, we have the transition from Moshe to Yehoshua. And the Pasuk tells us where Hashem tells Moshe, Kach es Yehoshua, take Yehoshua, v'samachta es yadcha alav, and place your hands on him. What we would refer to as smicha. Now, smicha that I have, and even smicha that Rabbi Goldberg has, despite the fact that he's a little bit older than me, right, is not real smicha. Right? We have fake smicha. I shouldn't say that loudly, but it's a certain sense of fake smicha. Real smicha was ish mi pi ish from Moshe Rabbeinu, person to person, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu, where they actually put their hands on their next student. What is the significance of this seemingly unnecessary ceremony? Why was it so important for Moshe to place his hands on Yehoshua? So Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a lecture in 1960 to a group of rabbinical students, answers that question by sharing the following Gemara. It's a Gemara that's found in Masechet Sanhedrin about the Romans when they're coming to destroy the Jewish people. We're going to read about that a lot in a few weeks when it comes to Tisha B'Av. But the Romans put out a decree that you're not allowed to teach Torah publicly. And if you do, you're going to be killed. And also, you're not allowed to give smicha. They wanted to cut off the chain of smicha going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, there was a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava who decided that he was going to courageously take five students and defy the decree of the Romans. He was going to give them smicha. Now, this wasn't just any five students. This was like the dream team of students. Rav Meir, Rav Yehuda, Rav Shimon, Rav Yossi, Rav Elezer ben Shamua. Those are not stam five rabbis. Those are like big rabbis. So he starts giving them smicha. The Romans catch them and they all start running. So Rav Yehuda ben Bava says, Banai, Rotsu, like get out of here, run. And he's ready to take one for the team there. So Amru Lo, the students say back to him, Rebbe, Mate Alecha, if we run, what's going to happen to you? He says, don't worry about it, go. Rav Yehuda ben Bava stands his ground, and he is left to die at the hands of the Romans in a very gruesome fashion. Asked Rabbi Soloveitchik in 1960, what gave Rav Yehuda Bava the permission to die for the sake of smicha? Right, we know that there are three big ones. Yarag v'yaver, shvichas damim, avodah zarah, those are the three you have to die for. But everything else you have to live for. So why did Rav Yehuda ben Bava go so crazy to die to give his students smicha? What gave him the right halachically to do that? Answers the Rav something very powerful. Rav Yehuda ben Bava gave smicha not to die, but to continue to live on. That by him conferring smicha to his students, by him guaranteeing the perpetuation of Judaism, he wasn't worried about dying. He was worried about passing that on to the next generation. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, that is the significance of the smicha ceremony. Because if you think about it, it actually doesn't make sense, right? In a teacher-student relationship, who should be leaning on whom? It's the student who relies on the teacher for information. Right? So let's say my son. So I teach my son Torah. My son is the student, I'm the teacher. Who's relying on who? I don't need him. I know the information already. He needs me to teach him the information. So who should be leaning on who? My son should be leaning on me because he needs me, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, but that's not what happens here. It's Moshe, the teacher, who leans on Yehoshua, the student. And that's because when Moshe leans on Yehoshua, what he's essentially saying is it's me, Moshe, who's relying on you, Yehoshua. I am relying on you to continue living on through you. That all of the work that I've done, and all of the sacrifices that I've made, all the learning that I've been part of, it all is lost if it stops with me. It's only not lost if it continues to live on through you. And so who needs who more? Does the teacher need the student or the student need the teacher? Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, the teacher needs the student. Because without the student, all the Torah that I know is lost. It's dead when I die. It's only through my students that that information continues to live on. And that's why it's Moshe who's placing his hands on Yehoshua. He's leaning on Yehoshua to say, I'm relying on you, Yehoshua, to carry on what I have taught you to the next generation, to perpetuate this Torah. And so says, that's what Rav Yehuda ben Bava. It wasn't to die, but it was to continue to live on and to continue to ensure that the Torah would live on as well. Think about that imagery for a second of Smicha, where it's the adult, the teacher, relying on the student to perpetuate and to live on through that student. If you think about it, that's exactly what at least I do, and hopefully many of you are able to do, either through children or grandchildren, every single Friday night. Every Friday night, whether in person or over the phone or over Zoom, we reenact the smicha process with our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. When we give them a bracha every Friday night, when we put our hands on our children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren's head and we say, Yesimcha Elokim Kefraim V'chemnashe V'recha Hashem V'ishmerecha, we give them the bracha on Friday night, we are reenacting a smicha process. We are placing our hands on the next generation. And it's not because they're relying on us, but it's because we're relying on them. And when we give them that bracha Friday night, it's an amazing thing to think about. When we give them that bracha Friday night, what essentially we're telling them is, I am leaning on you. I am relying on you to take everything I have taught you and to carry it on to the next generation. All of the sacrifices that I have made, all of the work that I have put in, all of the money I paid for Jewish education, it's not so that it stops here, but it's all so that it can continue to live on through you for generations to come. I want everyone here to think about that imagery tonight as you speak to children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren over the phone, and you confer upon them a bracha, to think about this notion of smicha, of we are relying on them for the next generation. So we did three ideas, 30 minutes. Idea number one was a very beautiful idea about the contrast between Yehoshua and Pinchas, two models of leadership. There's the bold, dramatic form of Pinchas, and there's the constant and consistent fashion of Yehoshua. Yehoshua ultimately takes the leadership because that's real life for all of us. Greatness is defined by small moments that add up over a lifetime. Idea number two was the beautiful idea of Al Dvar Pa'or, that Pa'or represented a free-for-all society. Do whatever I want, whenever I want, however I want. Judaism comes along and says, no, Kedusha is found in restrictions and in rules. That's what Halacha does for us. And idea number three, this beautiful, magnificent idea of Rabbi Soloveitchik, of this notion of smicha. Who is leaning on whom? Is it the teacher that leans on the student or the student that leans on the teacher? Counterintuitively, it is the teacher that leans on the student to show them that I need you to carry everything I've taught you on for future generations. We reenact that every Friday night when we give brachas to children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, where we essentially tell them, we look them in the eye and we say, all the work that I've done and all of the sacrifices that I've made and all of the traditions that I've been a part of, it's all so that it can continue to live on through you. Those are three ideas, exactly 30 minutes. I'm a Yeki, if nothing else. I want to wish everyone a beautiful, meaningful, inspirational Shabbos, and one that is filled with lots of